and welcome to another episode of Famous Failures, where I interview the world's most interesting people about the failures they've had in their lives and what they learned from them. I'm your host, Ozan Morol. Before I introduce today's guest, I have a request from you. The podcast is fairly new, so I would really appreciate your help in spreading the word. You can do that in one of three ways. You can tell your friends about the podcast, you can subscribe to the podcast on whatever platform that you're listening on, or you can leave a review on iTunes or Google Play. In addition, if you'd like to keep in touch with me and say hello to me, you can subscribe to my weekly newsletter, The Weekly Contrarian. It has thousands of subscribers, and readers call it the one email I look forward to each week. So every Thursday, you'll get a list of tools, articles, books, and other gems that challenge conventional wisdom and change the way that you look at the world. You can sign up for that by going to my website, ozanmorol.com, or texting my first name, Ozan, O-Z-A-N, to 345-345. And if you sign up now, you'll also get a free ebook called The Contrarian Handbook, 8 Principles for Innovating Your Thinking. And again, you can get that right now on the go by texting O-Z-A-N to 345-345 or heading over to my website, ozanmorol.com. Today's guest on Famous Failures is Barbara Oakley. Without a doubt, Barbara is one of the most interesting people I've ever had the pleasure of speaking with. She was a captain in the U.S. Army. She has 2 college degrees. She's fluent in numerous languages, and she met her husband while the two of them were working together at the South Pole. She defied the odds, as well as her early educators, by overcoming perceived weaknesses in math and science to become a professor of engineering. She teaches 2 massive open online courses. They're called Learning How to Learn and Mindshift. She's also an author. Her most recent book, Mindshift, discusses overcoming learning handicaps, including the imposter syndrome and advancing age by the simple yet powerful act of persistence. Without further ado, here's my conversation with Barbara Oakley.
What were your 3 most valuable failures?
Oh, that's almost tough because I've had so many and they've all been valuable. I think probably my first most valuable failure was that I was terrible in math and science, and I flunked my way through elementary, middle, and high school math and science, which is ironic given that I'm now a professor of engineering. But I think the value of that failure was that now as a professor, I never sit there and say, well, of course, it's intuitively obvious that, or I rarely say that kind of thing. I'm considered a very good teacher. I've won national teaching awards. And the reason for that is because when I teach, I really understand the struggle it takes to try to understand something in math or science. The only way that I can understand things myself is to dramatically simplify the key ideas and sometimes approach it through a metaphor that leads me to better understanding. At any rate, my dramatic early failures with math and science have made me more successful, I think, in the long run as a teacher of math and science.
What do you think was the reason for your early dislike of math and physics?
Some people have a natural gift for those subjects. We like to think, oh, everyone is the same. And it's not really true because some people are really adept and can learn much more quickly. And I was not one of those people. When we moved, I was about 7 years old. I remember we moved from Texas to Massachusetts and they were suddenly far ahead of me in the multiplication table. And I just realized it wasn't like I sat down and in a couple evenings caught all up and was on the same playing field as everyone else. It was really a struggle for me and I didn't like it. I didn't want to sit down and do it. When I did sit down and do it, it came slowly. And so I just sort of gave up on it. I think because of the age at which I lived, I just thought, oh, you know, I'm one of these girls who's just not that way. And I sort of stereotyped myself, you know, that's pretty much why I put that label on myself. And then once that label was there, it was really easy to confirm it with you know, just by, I still remember, let's see, there were a couple of things. In eighth grade, I was sent to the dean of students because I would just sit and read in classes, in math class. I wouldn't pay attention to the teacher. And I remember just saying to the dean of students, you know, I will never, ever in my life have anything to do with math. I hate it. It's useless. It's just awful. And they never bothered me after that. My teacher never said a word to me. I could sit and read and do whatever. So whatever I said in that, it apparently really made an impression that they were never, ever going to get me to do anything with math. And then I remember in chemistry in 11th grade, I had a good chemistry instructor, and I was busy flunking the class. And I remember just kind of going up to him after class, because my parents were concerned that I was flunking the class, and just kind of like, okay, come on, see if you can put it in my brain. You know, just really one of the world's worst students, really had an attitude. And so it was, I just kind of have to laugh at how much I've changed. And the reason I changed was actually my second big failure.
Correct.
And that was, I joined the military flying high. I wanted to learn another language, and they sent me to the Defense Language Institute, and I learned Russian, which I picked at random. And I thought I was just doing great, right? Because I did so well at the language school that I even got an in-service ROTC scholarship that allowed me to complete my first degree in Slavic languages and literature. And then the military made me a signal officer instead of military intelligence, which is what I'd been expecting. And I was horrified. I just thought, this is the worst thing that's ever happened to me. And of course, there are much worse, but I didn't know that at the time.
What does a signal officer do?
They are in charge of people who install switching systems, radio systems, all sorts of communication gear, layout cables, and so forth. And it's basically, it's something that, and someone who is trained well as an electrical engineer, that's the background you need for a job like that. And I didn't even know what a volt was, or if a signal has to go out on a cable, why does it have to come back? You know, why do you need two wires? I just, none of that made sense. And I was terrible at the job because it was easy to make mistakes because everything I was doing was just sort of by rote. Like I'd fill out the switching system cable routes and so forth. And I didn't really understand what was going on behind the scenes there. So I would just make mistakes and misroute cables and so forth. And I didn't know how anything tied together. And I was working with all these electrical engineers or West Point engineers. They all knew what they were doing. And I was just clueless. So I eventually felt so bad because I was pathetic at the job that I asked to be transferred. And I ended up pushing papers as an assistant adjutant. And that was a tremendous failure in my life. I mean, I was in West Germany for almost 4 years. And lonely, far away from my family, terrible at my job. I ended up just sort of going off into a little corner and pushing papers in kind of a make-work position that was made up for me. But what that did was that forced me to reevaluate how following my passion and just learning a language and not opening my mind to other things had really put me in a corner. The way the world is unfolding and was even unfolding at that time was to be sort of literate in the modern day world. You want to know at least a little bit about math and science and not be afraid of it. So that prompted me to go back to the university and see if I could maybe change my brain. I mean, I did have a GI Bill, which would allow me to study anything I wanted. So I decided to try and see if I could actually learn math and science because I could suddenly see that there really was a use and it could make a big difference in my career. And also there was a bit of the challenge of it was so alien to my personality that I just thought, wow, well, if I'm open to new adventures and so forth, this one is really an adventure that I should try because it's one I never could have imagined that I could do.
Sure, yeah. I mean, it's the best way to learn is to do something outside of your comfort zone, right?
Right.
So the reason you mentioned you were terrible at the signal officer job, I mean, obviously you're an extremely capable person. Was it because of the point you mentioned about the job requiring sort of rote memorization? Is that why you didn't excel at it?
Oh, no, not at all. Not at all. It required the ability to think logically and to understand at least a modicum of why and how the systems fit together. And I was such a technological Luddite that I just couldn't get it. I mean, I went to the signal officer basic training school where they try to give you just the basics that you need to understand radio systems and maybe how your telephone works so you can hook into your telephone and so forth. And I graduated last. And I think it was just, I was coming from, not from ground zero. I mean, I was coming from the sub-basement, you know, intellectual background about science and math. I mean, when I went back to the university, I started at Remedial High School Algebra. It was just, I think that the way I succeeded in the long run was I swallowed my pride. I started really low and I went slowly. And like the signal officer school was a good school, but because I was just so far behind and so in need of remedial stuff, it was just, I couldn't handle it. But when I just started and went at my own speed and then got the foundation I needed, it started building and I started doing better and better. And so then I was accepted into the electrical engineering program at the University of Washington and then went from, you know, like cum laude to summa cum laude to magna cum laude, you know, as I progressed through degrees. So my undergraduate was in electrical. My master's was electrical and computer. And then my PhD was in systems engineering with a lot of mechanical engineering.
Wow. Yeah, that's what an inspiring story going from being last in your class at Signal Officer School to rising up through the ranks to actually becoming a professor of electrical engineering. So as an academic, and you already have several books, but as an academic, how did you decide to write books for a general audience? And what roadblocks or failures did you encounter along the way?
Oh, good question. I have always wanted to be a writer. And it's kind of funny because my older sister was actually the real storyteller when we were young. And I think she inspired me to be a writer. But I just kept going with it. And there were some years, for example, when I was getting my doctorate, where you just couldn't write, right? Because it was, you're just going crazy doing what you can. But I always just kind of kept at it. And it's not like I always love it. It's just a compulsion that I have to do it. The first book was A Hair of the Dog that was about working on the Soviet trawlers. And I did that before I got into academia. The second one was Evil Genes, Why Rome Fell, Hitler Rose, Enron Failed, and My Sister Stole My Mother's Boyfriend. And I did that one while I was working to get tenure. My children were really small. My father was dying of Alzheimer's. And I'm, you know, trying to do all this research to make sure I get the tenure and so forth. And still in the corner, I was going off and kind of working on this book for 6 years. And I just kept working at it. And I thought, this is a pretty nutty thing to do because nobody's ever going to want to even look at a book about psychology that is written by an engineering professor. What could she possibly know? But I felt that the field of psychology had some major issues with it that were glaringly obvious, and yet no one was writing about them. And so I felt that the work was important to do. And it went to 40 different publishers. That so you want to talk about rejection. but I just kept working on it. And finally, publisher number 41 Prometheus picked up on the book. And it was, as I had conjectured, it got accolades from top psychologists, top psychiatrists. Steven Pinker wrote a great blurb. And there really was the glaringly obvious flaws that I was pointing towards really were there. And I mean, it wasn't rocket science or anything. It was like, wait a minute, you guys are using these terms that have no scientific foundation and writing thousands of pages about them as if you know what you're talking about and you don't. And that's a problem. And of course, the book was controversial because at that time, biology wasn't, you weren't supposed to say that biology played any role whatsoever. And the book is actually a very balanced role of both biology and the environment in people's development. So I think it's kind of funny because I think it's almost like you have to go through this long spell in the desert where the universities don't like your work, your side work, if you're writing popular books, because they just want you to be bringing in research dollars. But if you can make it through to the other side of the desert, then they're really happy with your work because you're bringing you know, a lot of attention to that university by virtue of the fact that people really know of your work and admire it. So if you can get through the desert without, you know, dying of thirst, there is a promised land sort of on the other side.
The final question that I'll ask, which I asked to all of my guests so far, is how are you failing right now?
Oh, how am I failing? Oh, I guess, well, that's a good question because I'm trying to be so intelligent about putting my efforts in the baskets where they really need to be put that I actually feel like I'm doing pretty well now.
That's great.
If I'm failing at anything, it's that I have two major projects and it's a little bit hard to make sure I'm giving each one the full attention that it deserves. But I think I'm doing okay. So I should have a failure story for you now. But I'm sure that, I'll probably find out within the next few years what the failure is that's going on right now.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for listening. Two things before you take off. First, if you don't want to miss out on future episodes of Famous Failures, please subscribe to the podcast on whatever platform you're listening on and be sure to leave a review on iTunes or Google Play. Second, if you'd like to join thousands of others who receive a short email from me each Thursday with a list of articles, books, tools, quotes, and other gems that help you discover how extraordinary thinking produces extraordinary results, you can text my first name, which is Ozan, that's spelled O-Z-A-N, to 345-345. So once again, that's my first name, Ozan, O-Z-A-N, to 345-345. Or if you're in front of your computer, you can head over to ozanvarol.com and drop your email address. If you act now, you'll also get a free ebook called The Contrarian Handbook, 8 Principles to Innovate Your Thinking. As always, thank you for listening and see you next time.